nation, what markets are all about is the proposition of give me that which I want, and I will give you that which you want. And we work and we specialize in different things to do that. So the market, you know, capitalism, is really one big system or network of international cooperation under the division of labor in society. And it's peaceful and it's voluntary. And as long as there's no force or fraud, it works very well. And that is exactly the opposite, precisely the opposite of war, because with war, this whole system, as Mises said, bursts asunder. It's destroyed, because a war stops the whole international division of labor. If you look at world history, for example, the Industrial Revolution, the economic historians talk about a first Industrial Revolution, which is basically the first half of the 19th century, and then they talk about a second Industrial Revolution that's all the developments in technology and industry that took place roughly in the second half of the 19th century. And so, you know, human society really progressed in many ways. The income in the United States, for example, personal income grew at about 3 to 5% a year, every year, year in and year out during the 19th century, and especially after slavery was ended and we had relatively freer markets in labor, we had the Second Industrial Revolution. And so people all over the world were benefiting, they were living longer and they were working less but making more money because of productivity growth, thanks mostly to capital investment by entrepreneurs. And people from all over the world were benefiting from the products that people made elsewhere through international trade. And then World War I comes along, and it really did burst asunder this whole international trading system. It essentially put on hold the international division of labor and the ability of the world to prosper from the international division of labor. It basically for 80 years, because we have World War I, and then we had the Great Depression of the 1930s, and then World War II, and then the Cold War, and the adoption of communism in much of the planet during the Cold War, during World War II, and after World War II. And so it really wasn't until the final collapse of socialism in the late 80s and early 1990s that the whole world really returned to where it was in 1916, in terms of the ability of people to freely do business with one another all around the world, globalization, if you will. Of course, there was never zero globalization. There was always trade to some degree, but it was largely disrupted by really the warfare state. It all started with World War I, and that's an important economic lesson to keep in mind, I think, the difference between the international division of labor on one hand, which is peaceful exchange through the free market, and war, which is mass murder, mass killing, mass destruction, and also an enormous growth of the state. Of course, Mises also talks about the myth of war profiteering. There's no such thing as war prosperity, for example, because what war means is that resources that would normally be used in a consumer society are massively transferred to the government to be used for war making. And so even if it's a just war, even if it's a defensive war, still it is impoverishing. And wars are always impoverishing to the winners and the losers because, among other things, they divert capital accumulation away from those uses of machinery and equipment and so forth that would have benefited consumers to the government's killing machine. And as I said, even if it's a defensive war, it doesn't matter what side you're on. And so war is always impoverishing, although there are such things as war profiteers. There are people who make a lot of money by selling arms and so forth to the government. So yes, there are war profiteers, but the rest of the society is made worse off. And von Mises also talks historically about the European wars under the European monarchs throughout history. And he makes note of the fact that wars were always for many generations, really affairs between the monarchs. The monarchs had mostly mercenary armies that they would employ to try to conquer each other and steal from each other. And the role of the citizen was pretty much to try to stay out of the way. And international law did evolve over the centuries so that there was widespread agreement around the world that it was illegitimate and a crime, a war crime, to intentionally target civilians, to bomb or burn cities, to steal their property, although armies were permitted to forage, to feed themselves, although the accepted practice, the civilized practice, was to attempt to pay for food and supplies from the population, although it's sort of like the law of eminent domain. The government names a price and you take it or leave it. But still, that's what international law said. By the time you get to the 19th century, it was pretty well established that it was a war crime, and you should have been hanged as a war criminal if you were guilty of murdering civilians intentionally during a wartime. And so the civilians were pretty much, their job was to stay out of it. But the development of the nation state changed all that, and especially the development of democracy, because with democracy and a nation state, wars became our wars. They weren't just the king's wars. They were everyone's wars. They were national wars. They were wars of one nation against another nation. And so conscription came into being. And then that created a whole different type of war. It created eventually a total war, total world war, in World War I and World War II. And so it was thought for a while, as Mises points out, that democracy, the advent of democracy, would actually diminish war or diminish the incidence of war, make it less frequent because of the fact that, well, the original wars, in medieval times were between the monarchs. If you end the monarchies, well, then you've eliminated this incentive of one monarch to try to conquer the other monarch through invasion. Well, history proves that that didn't really work out that way. Napoleon, after the French Revolution, was sort of an imperialistic character. And of course, the wealthiest democracy in the world, the United States, is also the most warlike in the world. We've had dozens and dozens of military interventions over the past 100 years by the U.S. military. And so these are some of the points that von Mises made and that Rothbard makes also in some of his writings. And another important point about history that von Mises makes that Rothbard has mentioned also is that one of the causes of war in Europe, in European history, was autarky. That's spelled A-U-T-A-R-K-Y, autarky, where, and this was especially true of Nazi Germany, where the economic policy was to try to become self-sufficient or self-sustaining in an economy. But the problem that Germany faced was that they didn't have the natural resources that were sufficient to be self-sustaining or to practice autarky. So they attempted to conquer their neighbors and steal their resources so that the one big German nation could be independent and isolated from the international division of labor. And so the refusal to participate in the free market in the international division of labor was a major cause of the belligerency of the 20th century. And another major cause was economic interventionism per se, because economic interventionism inevitably is harmful to an economy and impoverishing to an economy. And historically, a lot of politicians had the impulse of responding to the impoverishment of their own countries that their own policies caused by trying to bail themselves out by conquering their neighbors. And so the lesson that von Mises gives there is that democracy is not a sufficient condition leading to a reduced incidence of warfare. It has to be laissez-faire capitalism and freedom in addition to democracy. That would be a better recipe for peace, not just democracy per se. Okay, and that's the point that he made. Rothbard was a big fan of Robert Higgs, and Robert Higgs' book, Crisis and Leviathan, And although Rothbard himself wrote about many of the topics that are in The Crisis of Leviathan many years before that book was published, and that book was published in 1987, and it's what it looks like, The Crisis of Leviathan by Robert Higgs, and I recommend this to everyone. And in Crisis of Leviathan, which Shmuel Rothbard praised at the treetops, Bob Higgs explains the ratchet effect of crises such as war. And basically what the ratchet effect is about is when whenever there's an emergency such as a war, that government always ratchets up its own powers. It increases taxes sometimes tremendously. During World War II, for example, the highest marginal tax rate was increased all the way to 94%. 94%. Highest tax rate. There's also usually an attack on civil liberties, and so civil liberties are often suspended for the duration of the war, or at least some of them are. There have been nationalization of industries, de facto nationalization of industries through government regulation, government demanding that private enterprises pay whatever price it means. There have been laws forcing businesses to transform themselves to produce tanks instead of automobiles and things like that. And so governmental power is always ratchet up during wartime. And then when the war is over, they ratchet back down, but not all the way down to where they were originally. And so the end result of any war is usually a permanently higher growth path of governmental power. And there are governmental institutions such as the military, industrial, congressional complex that are created and enhanced and nourished during war, and when the war is over, they never disappear. They're with us forever. Maybe not in as big a degree as they were, or as powerful and influential as they were during the war, but they're still there. And so that's basically what the ratchet effect is. And I'm going to talk about some illustrations of this during wartime. And so that would be one recommended reading, Crisis and Leviathan by Bob Higgs. And another article that Murray Rothbard was quite fond of, which is a real classic, is War is the Health of the State by Randolph Bourne. It's spelled B-O-U-R-N-E, Randolph Bourne. And it really is a really deep article. Randolph Bourne was a young man in his early 30s when he wrote it. It was published in 1918. And he died shortly thereafter that. And so I'll mention some of the things that Randolph Bourne says in this, because Rothbard quotes this article in quite a few places in his writings on war. And so I just kind of jotted down some of the main and very interesting points that Bourne made that Rothbard would have agreed with and did agree with in a lot of his writing. And the one point is that wars are never the result of a mandate. The people. The people never want war, the average people. It's usually maybe a couple of dozen people in the government, usually the executive branch of the government, who do all the conniving and backstabbing and manipulating, and then they call it statesmanship, but that's how we get into war. It's usually behind closed doors of a couple of dozen people in different countries who cause all this trouble. And then, however, once the war starts, it seems to be very easy for governments to convince the public that it's their war. That it's not the war of a small handful of politicians and their financial benefactors in the armaments industry or whoever is behind it. No, it's our war. It's a war of all Americans. If we're going to wage war in Libya or the Sudan or someplace like that, somehow. It's all of ours for our responsibility. It's all of our problem, even though it was instigated by just a few dozen people. And of course, the more powerful the executive branch becomes, the more likely we will see more and more of this sort of behavior. And then also during wartime, when people are feeling threatened, or at least they think they're threatened, they allow themselves to be regimented and coerced much more than if they don't feel threatened. And so that's why war is the health of the state. The state always wants to regiment and coerce us. It really is a totalitarian institution, no matter what you call it, whether you call it democracy or dictatorship or anything else. And so also what happens is the criticism of the state is always ferociously attacked during wartime. And so, and I'm going to give quite a few examples of this in a minute. Randolph Bourne also makes the point that it sort of seems to be a natural human tendency that we have an innate desire to behave like children, to be children, and to have a parent taking care of us, no matter how old we get, that a lot of us, not every single individual, but a lot of us have this sort of desire for mom and dad to take care of us. And war does that opportunity, gives us that opportunity for Uncle Barack or Uncle George W. Bush to take care of us, to watch over us, to protect us. And so we give up our freedom for that. Pacifists are often terrorized. For example, during World War I in the United States, Eugene Debs, the socialist candidate for president, was imprisoned for reading the Constitution in public, as were quite a few other people. There's also the oppression of minorities, that is, not racial minorities, but minority dissenters. And there has been the imprisonment in the United States of anti-war proponents over the years. And so there really is no such thing as democratic control of foreign policy. When we have war that is a result of so-called statesmanship of foreign policy, democracy usually goes down the tubes, and the people acquiesce in dictatorship. And the people just pretty much accept the ruling class's dictates. And one of the things that makes this much easier to accomplish is what economists call fiscal illusions. That is, when war can be financed through money printing or even borrowing government debt, it tends to disguise or hide the cost of war. Because if you can imagine sending each family a $50,000 tax bill, they would probably hesitate to be such good supporters of it. Compared to the situation of where the government can simply print up a lot of money and get the money to finance the war that way. That's called fiscal illusion. And so it's easy to be a patriot, to wave the flag, to put those silly yellow ribbons on your car, and to put, my son is in the Navy, bumper sticker on the back of your car, and things like that. If you don't think it costs you anything financially, it's easier. Of course, a lot of people do understand that those who pay the highest price are often the soldiers, because the soldiers not only fight the war, but if they make it back alive or in one piece, they end up, like the rest of us, paying higher taxes usually for the rest of their lives than pay off their share of the government debt that was incurred to pay for the war. And so fiscal illusion is one of the tools the government uses to dupe the public into going along with war. And just some historical examples of all this, of which there are many, I'll start with the Lincoln administration in the Civil War in the United States. There was press censorship. There was the Lincoln administration shut down over 300 northern newspapers for merely criticizing Lincoln and his administration. One source of this, the book called Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln by James G. Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. He was the preeminent Lincoln scholar of the last generation, and many historians think he was the preeminent Lincoln scholar of all time. Another book that talks about this is Freedom Under Lincoln by Dean Sprague, S-P-R-A-G-U-E. So it talks about how hundreds of newspapers were shut down. Sometimes the printing presses were demolished by roving gangs of Republican Party hacks. Some of the editors and owners of the newspapers were imprisoned. There were tens of thousands of northern state political dissenters who were imprisoned without due process because the writ of habeas corpus was suspended. And when the Chief Justice of the United States issued the opinion that it was unconstitutional for Lincoln to have gotten rid of habeas corpus, Lincoln responded by issuing an arrest warrant for the Chief Justice, Roger B. Taney. And this is I validated this in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, with several very, very unimpeachable sources. There was a mass murder of dissenters in the during wartime in terms of Southerners during the American Civil War simply no longer consented to being governed by Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. responded with a war that ended up killing as many as 400 to about 450,000 of them. That's the latest estimate of Civil War deaths in the South, not the North. The total death toll is the latest update, just in a couple of years, is about 800 to 850,000 deaths. The 620,000 number existed for about 100 years. But modern forensic research has enabled modern researchers to settle upon this much higher number, and it's pretty much been accepted by the American history profession. War often leads to conscription, which of course is a form of slavery. You know, when the United States outlawed slavery with the 13th Amendment, it outlawed involuntary servitude. So what else would you call military conscription but involuntary servitude? And both sides in the Civil War, in America, adopted conscription, and we had it also in World War I, World War II, and after that, through the Vietnam War. And so this was, you know, the record civil liberty, part of the record of civil liberties abuses. Even the most outspoken dissenter in Congress was a Democrat from Akron, Ohio, named Clement Vallandigham, and he was deported by the Lincoln administration. He ended up in Canada after the war. And so that was the war. As far as the ratchet effect of the Civil War, well, federalism was destroyed because the citizens of the states no longer had a right of secession or a right of nullification of unconstitutional federal laws. And the states, all the states, North and South, really became mere appendages of the central government of Washington, D.C. in 1865. Another effect, ratchet effect of the American Civil War was that it established the idea that the federal government will be the sole decision maker with regard to whatever the limits would be on its own powers through the Supreme Court. Prior to the American Civil War, presidents had an equal opinion. Congress had an equal opinion. The citizens of the states often voiced their equal opinion on the constitutionality of federal laws, but the government declared for itself a constitutional monopoly of interpretation in 1865, and that's why to this day we have the black-robed deities of the Supreme Court telling us what our liberties are to be. The old Jeffersonians thought it would be insane to fight a revolution in the name of liberty and then put everybody's liberty in the hands of five government lawyers with lifetime tenure, the majority of the Supreme Court. They said over and over again that if that day ever arrived, then we would live under a tyranny. That day arrived in mid-1865 in the United States. Okay. And so these are just some of the ratchet effects, as I would call them, of the Civil War. And then when you get to World War I, I'm going to read a quote from page 123 of Crisis and Leviathan by Robert Higgs that explains the ratchet effects, some of the interventions of the World War I in the United States. He says, at the time of the armistice, the government and the nations, the government had taken over the ocean shipping, railroad, telephone, and telegraph industries, commandeered hundreds of manufacturing plants, entered into massive economic enterprises on its own account in such varied departments as shipbuilding, wheat trading, and building construction, undertaken to lend huge sums to businesses directly or indirectly, and to regulate private issuance of securities, and established official priorities for the use of transportation facilities, food, fuel, and many raw materials. It fixed the prices of dozens of important commodities, intervened in hundreds of labor disputes, and conscripted millions of men for service in the armed forces. It had, in short, extensively distorted or wholly displaced markets, creating what some contemporaries called war socialism. And indeed it did. In fact, Rothbard wrote several essays about this, in which he pointed out that the so-called progressives of the early 20th century, Richard T. Ely, the economist, John Dewey, the philosopher, among them, and quite a few others, the Nation magazine, and Herbert Crowley, who was the original editor of that, they were all in favor of American intervention in World War I because they thought the war would prove that socialist central planning could work. And they wanted to be able to make the argument that socialist central planning works to help us win the war. Therefore, when the war is over, we should and could use socialist central planning in peacetime. They wanted to do away with capitalism. So the so-called progressives who wanted to do away with capitalism and markets altogether and impose Soviet-style central planning thought that World War I would be a good demonstration project. And so they all to a man supported it, although never enough that any of them would volunteer for the army themselves. Richard T. Ely, John Dewey, all the rest, they were all chicken hawks like Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh, and Sean Hannity, and all these other warmongering talking heads of today who have never been in the military, never joined, or they were draft dodgers when they had their chance. The so-called progressives of the early 20th century were just like them, really, really identical to them. And so this was war socialism, and it was a demonstration project. A good example of the ratchet effect of World War I on taxes was that in 1913, the original income tax had a first bracket of only 1% and a top bracket of 7%. And you had to make $20,000 a year in 1913 to pay 1% in federal income tax. And so that was way, way above the average middle class income in 1913. And to reach the top bracket of 7% federal income, you had to make $500,000 in 1913. So only the John D. Rockefellers of the world were paying that top rate of 7% income tax. By 1920, World War I is over. The first bracket had was still up from 1% to 4%. And but you only had to make $4,000 to be in the 4% bracket. And the top bracket had increased in 1920 from 7% to 73%, but you had to make $1 million. Then by 1928, the first bracket went down to 1.8%, although it's still a tiny bit higher than the original bracket, but you only had to make $4,000. So the middle class was snared. World War I was used to snare the middle class and put them under the boot of the income tax. And so by 1928 also, the top bracket was all the way up to 25%, and you only had to make $100,000, not $1 million, $100,000, and by 1928 to be in that top bracket of 25%. And then, of course, by World War II, the bracket was increased to 94%. And even decades after World War II, by 1980, the top income tax bracket in the United States was still 70%, a far cry from the original 7%. So that was one big bait-and-switch racket, as I would call it, and it's a good example of ratchet effects that Rothbard and Robert Higgs illustrate in their writings on the war. And, of course, conscription occurred during World War I. And also during World War I, the Conscription Act allowed for a $10,000 fine and what was the penalty? I think it was 10 years in jail for discouraging enlistment in the Army. So if you were heard publicly discouraging anyone from joining the Army, then you could be subject to imprisonment and a very heavy fine. That was part of the Conscription Act that existed during World War I. And so many thousands of men were conscripted. The Fed was put into place, and of course, during World War I, so we had a doubling of the price level. We used inflation, price inflation, to finance a lot of World War I, and the dollar lost about half its value as far as that goes. And so the same thing, World War II was a carbon copy of World War I in terms of nationalization of some industries, the government taking over industries and ordering them to produce things for the government at prices the government wanted. And 11 million men were conscripted during World War I, or World War II rather, World War II. And also, there were thousands of, I think the number is 110,000 Japanese Americans were thrown into concentration camps for the duration of the war, even though not one of them was even accused of a crime, even a misdemeanor, let alone convicted of anything. But the only reason this was done is that they were Japanese Americans, and some of them were second and third generation Japanese Americans. And so just on the basis of their ethnic background, they were imprisoned and forced to live behind barbed wire in prison camps, and their property was seized and stolen by the government. Newspapers, radio, and television were censored during World War II in the United States. And as I said, entire industries were seized. There were price controls were pervasive, and they caused shortages that were pervasive. There was an Office of Price Administration. And so the free market was once again abolished during World War II, and we practiced war socialism once again during World War II. And this is why people like Charles Sumner, who was a libertarian sociologist in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, he said this. He said, the traditions of the army are a menace to liberty. And he said, militarism, expansion, and imperialism all favor plutocracy. It's always the war profiteers who benefit, who want the war. But the average citizen, the average taxpayer, is nothing really but tax fodder and cannon fodder. And so Rothbard understood, as does Robert Higgs, that these abolitions of civil liberties that occur, even though they're usually done away with after the war, they're never done away with completely, and they're always kept in the back pockets of the politicians. The politicians always drag these precedents out the next time they want warrantless wiretaps or the suspension of habeas corpus. And they don't really need to use war as an emergency, any old emergency. It could be a food emergency. It could be anything. It could be an electricity emergency, a hurricane emergency. And so once these precedents are established, they forever become precedents. And some politician somewhere will use them as an excuse. One of the strangest examples in recent years was when a few years ago, when the dictator of Pakistan declared martial law in his country, he in his announcement, he named Abraham Lincoln. He said, well, Abraham Lincoln did this. He suspended habeas corpus, so how could you criticize me, the dictator of Pakistan, for doing something that Abe Lincoln did? After all, Abe Lincoln is a saint, isn't he? And so that's yet another example of using what I would call the myth of Abraham Lincoln as an excuse to destroy American liberty in today's world. And that indeed is one of the main reasons why there's so much mythology about the man they call Father Abraham. So these are some of the things that I wanted to highlight in terms of the Rothbardian analysis of war. Like I said, he wrote an awful lot on the subject, philosophically, historically, the economics of war, but these are the things that I decided to pick out as sort of highlights, I think, some aspects of each, a little bit of philosophy from Randolph Bourne, a little bit of history, a little bit of economics from Ludwig Mises. That's the Rothbardian analysis of war for you. Okay, and so... So I guess I'll stop there and take any questions that anybody might have. Those of you who might have come on a little late because we had a little problem with the password, I have made up a final exam, and Danny Sanchez has it. And so I'm sure he will make it available to the class in the next day or two. And if anyone wants a grade for the course, you can take the final. Thanks to Ken for doing his usual great job. I see he has all these links already in the chat. Let's see, Glenn is asking, were our founding fathers against conscription? No, they used conscription. Actually, I think the first federal conscription law, Civil War, the federal would have been the Lincoln administration. The Confederates had a conscription law also. But one instance of conscription was the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania in the 1790s, when farmers in western Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh, were tax protesters because Alexander Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, conspired with Congress to impose a special tax on whiskey. And Pennsylvania farmers had been distilling, using wheat and grain to make alcohol, and selling alcohol rather than selling the wheat and grain. And so they thought that they were discriminated against by the tax system because, you know, tobacco doesn't have a special tax, rice doesn't have a special tax, cotton doesn't have a special tax, why us? And so they became tax protesters, and Hamilton himself convinced George Washington to get some of the governors along the eastern seaboard to conscript some 15,000 men. So this was done by 15,000 men, and they were mostly eastern seaboard, and ride into western Pennsylvania to apprehend the tax protesters. And I write about this in Hamilton's Purse. And the officers who were watching over these conscripts were mostly bondholders who held the government bonds from up and down the eastern seaboard. I wanted to make sure there was enough money in the treasury to pay off their bonds. And so they happily went along with Washington and Hamilton, and they rounded up a couple of dozen of the leaders of the tax protesters and had them march all the way from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia in the winter, some of them with bare feet. And some of these men were Revolutionary War veterans, too. And Hamilton wanted to hang them all, but George Washington, who left in the middle of all this, pardoned everyone. But these were conscripts that were, the president did call, ask the governor, several New England, New York, and that area, states on the eastern seaboard, to provide an army, and they did. And that's what the founders did, as far as I know, with conscription. Matt wants to know, when and to what degree is collateral damage permissible in war? Well, under international law, never. The murder of civilians is a war crime. And they call it collateral damage, but it should be called the murder of civilians. It's not collateral. It's a euphemism. And so, all through the history of wars, the bombing of European cities, the dropping of the atomic bomb, these were all war crimes of the highest order, to be sure. But the winners never get prosecuted for war crimes, only the losers do, and so we don't see a lot of prosecutions for this sort of thing. Scott is asking, any federal court decisions on unconstitutionality of conscription? Well, the United States Supreme Court rubber stamped everything during World War I and World War II in terms of conscription. And the imprisonment of people for reading the Bill of Rights in public, the Supreme Court said, it's all okey-doke. And by the time you get to World War II, you had Roosevelt appointees on the court who was rubber stamped everything he did. The nationalization of industry, which is really an attack on private property for which there is no constitutional authority in the actual Constitution. And so we had judicial activists during the World War I era and the World War II era who simply rubber stamped anything the government wanted to do with regard to the abolition of civil liberties during wartime. I'm not sure what this means, what economically negates the warring state. Let's see, Lewis is asking about the comment. Well, I didn't say that. That's Randolph Bourne said that people naturally have a tendency to be taken care of like children. I don't know if that's a part of human nature or not, or if we have evolved in that way. The nanny state does work mightily to treat us all like children by proposing more and more cradle to the grave care for us. So I think a lot of what the state has done over the past few years has been the infantilization of society. In fact, Hans Hermann Hoppe talks about this and makes this very point in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed. He talks about how the growth of government does lead to what he calls the infantilization of society. So I would recommend reading Democracy, the God That Failed by Hans Hermann Hoppe in response to this question. Cam has the link in there already, I see. See, do we have some more questions from the class? Sit around here. Well, Lewis wants to know, is war taking away more liberties or the financial crises? I think war, by all means. Financial crises, even during the Great Depression, which did lead to government interventionism, it was nothing like the mass nationalization of industry that took place in World War I. And the throwing people in prison and the abolition of free speech that occurred during the American Civil War, World War I, World War II. People were not put in concentration camps by the hundreds of thousands because of any financial crisis. So I think the war has been the mortal enemy of constitutional liberty for a long, long time. Even though everyone who joins the army takes an oath to defend the Constitution, the end result of wars is the whittling away of constitutional liberty, even if it's a defensive war. See, Matt Faraday says, are weapons sanctions the proper tool used against aggressive governments? Well, it depends on what an aggressive government is. There are no governments in the world today who are being aggressive against me as an American citizen. You have a lot of politicians and pundits on television lying about it, saying, for example, that Iran wants to drop a bomb on me somehow. Even though Iran knows that if they ever try to do that, then we could incinerate the entire country with nuclear bombs in a few seconds. And so it's sort of a myth that's out there that there are, the United States military has more firepower than all the militaries of all the other countries in the world combined. And so who's aggressing against us? And sanctions are an act of war. If you want to instigate a war, if you want to start a war for some sort of clandestine reason, well, that's often what happens is sanctions of various sorts, as they're called. But it really is an act of war. And we do have a long history of our politicians instigating wars. Lincoln himself thanked his naval commander, Gustavus Fox, for helping him dupe the Confederates into firing the first shot at Fort Sumter, where no one was hurt, let alone killed, so that he could justify a full-scale waging of total war on the entire southern population, which he obviously wanted to do. We had the dubious sinking of the Maine to get us into the Spanish-American War. Even Pearl Harbor, the United States was waging economic war on Japan for years prior to Pearl Harbor. And so these are the things Randolph Bourne talks about, a small handful of politicians instigating wars, and sanctions is one of their tools. If you got anything else here. Okay to run out of gas. This is the last week, 8th week. Well, it seems as though we're running out of gas here, folks. Okay. Well, we'll just call it a day then, I guess. We'll quit a little earlier tonight and give you time to prepare, those of you who are taking Dooley's course on World War One. And I guess this is a good little entree to that. And thank you all for attending. I hope you learned a lot about the Rothbardian analysis of the state, and I hope you keep educating yourself and making use of the Mises Academy. And have a great night.